The Walls fish the Bay of Ice and warn their little ones that Iron Man will carry them off if they don't behave. To reach them, your grace must pass through the Norris lands, however. They live the nearest to the gift and have always been good friends to the Watch. I could give you guides. Could? Stannis miss little. Or will? Will. You'll need them. And some sure-footed Garans, too. The paths up there are little more than goat tracks. Goat tracks? The king's eyes narrowed. I speak of moving swiftly, and you waste my time with goat tracks? When the young dragon conquered Dorne, he used a goat track to bypass the Dornish watchtowers on the Boneway. I know that tale as well, but Daeren made too much of it in that vainglorious book of his. Ships won that war, not goat tracks. Oakenfist broke the Planky Town and swept halfway up the Green Blood, whilst the main Dornish strength was engaged in the Prince's Pass. Stannis drummed his fingers on the map. These mountain lords will not hinder my passage? Only with feasts. Each will try to outdo the other with his hospitality. My lord father said he never ate half so well as when visiting the clans. For 3,000 men, I suppose I can endure some pipes and porridge, the king said, though his tone begrudged even that. John turned to Melisandre. My lady, fair warning. The old gods are strong in those mountains. The clansmen will not suffer insults to their heart trees. That seemed to amuse her. Have no fear, Jon Snow. I will not trouble your mountain savages and their dark gods. My place is here with you and your brave brothers. That was the last thing Jon Snow would have wanted. But before he could object, the king said, Where would you have me lead these stalwarts, if not against the Dreadfort? John glanced down at the map. Deepwood Mott. He tapped it with a finger. If Bolton means to fight the Iron Men, so must you. Deepwood is a Mott and Bailey castle, in the midst of thick forest, easy to creep up on, unawares. A wooden castle, defended by an earthen dike and a palisade of logs. The going will be slower through the mountains, admittedly, but up there your host can move unseen, to emerge almost at the gates of Deepwood. Stannis rubbed his jaw. When Balon Greyjoy rose the first time, I beat the Iron Men at sea, where they are fiercest. On land, taken unawares, I have won a victory over the wildlings and their king beyond the wall. If I can smash the Iron Men as well, the North will know it has a king again. And I will have 1,000 wildlings, thought John, and no way to feed even half that number.
Tyrion. I do not sleep as I did when I was younger, Grand Maester Pycelle told him, by way of apology for the dawn meeting. I would sooner be up, though the world be dark, than lie restless abed, fretting on tasks undone, he said, though his heavy-lidded eyes made him look half asleep as he said it. In the airy chambers beneath the rookery, his girl served them boiled eggs, stewed plums, and porridge, while Pycelle served the pontifications. In these sad times, when so many hunger, I think it only fitting to keep my table spare. Commendable, Tyrion admitted, breaking a large brown egg that reminded him unduly of the Grand Maester's bald, spotted head. I take a different view. If there is food, I eat it, in case there's none on the morrow. He smiled. Tell me, are your ravens early risers as well? Pycelle stroked the snowy beard that flowed down his chest. To be sure. Shall I send for quill and ink after we have eaten? No need. Tyrion laid the letters on the table beside his porridge, twin parchments tightly rolled and sealed with wax at both ends. Send your girl away so we can talk. Leave us, child, Pycelle commanded. The serving girl hurried from the room.
These letters now.
For the eyes of Doran Martell, Prince of Dawn. Tyrion peeled the crack shell away from his egg and took a bite. It wanted salt.
One letter in two copies. Send your swiftest birds. The matter is of great import. I shall dispatch them as soon as we have broken our fast. Dispatch them now. Stewed plums will keep. The realm may not. Lord Renly is leading his host up the Rose Road, and no one can say when Lord Stannis will sail from Dragonstone.
Pycelle blinked.
If my lord prefers. He does. I am here to serve.
The maester pushed himself ponderously to his feet, his chain of office clinking softly. It was a heavy thing, a dozen maester's collars threaded around and through each other and ornamented with gemstones. And it seemed to Tyrion that the gold and silver and platinum links far outnumbered those of baser metals. Pycelle moved so slowly that Tyrion had time to finish his egg and taste the plums, overcooked and watery to his taste, before the sound of wings prompted him to rise. He spied the raven, dark in the dawn sky, and turned briskly toward the maze of shelves at the far end of the room. The maester's medicines made an impressive display. Dozens of pots sealed with wax, hundreds of stoppered vials, as many milk glass bottles, countless jars of dried herbs, each container neatly labelled in Pycelle's precise hand. An orderly mind, Tyrion reflected, and indeed, once you had puzzled out the arrangement, it was easy to see that every potion had its place. And such interesting things. He noted sweet sleep and nightshade, milk of the poppy, the tears of lice, powdered greycap, wolfsbane, and demon's dance. Basilisk venom, blind eye, widow's blood. Standing on his toes and straining upward, he managed to pull a small dusty bottle off the high shelf. When he read the label, he smiled and slipped it up his sleeve. He was back at the table, peeling another egg, when Grand Maester Pycelle came creeping down the stairs.
"It is done, my lord," the old man seated himself. "A matter like this best done promptly. Indeed. Indeed. Of great import, you say?" "Oh, yes."
The porridge was too thick, Tyrion felt, and wanted butter and honey. To be sure, butter and honey were seldom seen in King's Landing of late, though Lord Giles kept them well supplied in the castle. Half of the food they ate these days came from his lands, or Lady Tander's. Rosby and Stokeworth lay near the city to the north, and were yet untouched by war.
"The Prince of Dawn himself. Might I ask?"
"Best not."
"As you say."
Pycelle's curiosity was so ripe that Tyrion could almost taste it.
"Mayhaps the King's Council?"
Tyrion tapped his wooden spoon against the edge of the bowl.
"The council exists to advise the king, maester."
"Just so," said Pycelle. "And the king is a boy of 13. I speak with his voice."
"So you do, indeed. The king's own hand. Yet, your most gracious sister, our queen regent, she bears a great weight upon those lovely white shoulders of hers. I have no wish to add to her burdens. Do you?"
Tyrion cocked his head and gave the Grand Maester an inquiring stare. Pycelle dropped his gaze back to his food. Something about Tyrion's mismatched green and black eyes made men squirm. Knowing that, he made good use of them.
"Ah," the old man muttered into his plums, "doubtless you have the right of it, my lord. It is most considerate of you to spare her this burden."
"That's just the sort of fellow I am,"
Tyrion returned to his unsatisfactory porridge.
consider it. Circe is my own sweet sister, after all. And a woman, to be sure, Grandmaster Pycelle said. A most uncommon woman, and yet it is no small thing to tend to all the cares of the realm, despite the frailty of her sex.
Oh, yes, she's a frail dove. Just ask Eddard Stark.
I'm pleased you share my concern. I thank you for the hospitality of your table, but a long day awaits.
He swung his legs out and clambered down from his chair.
Be so good as to inform me at once, should we receive a reply from Dorne. As you say, my lord. And only me. To be sure.
Pycelle's spotted hand was clutching at his beard the way a drowning man clutches for a rope. It made Tyrion's heart glad. One, he thought. He waddled out into the lower bailey. His stunted legs complained of the steps. The sun was well up now, and the castle was stirring. Guardsmen walked the walls, and knights and men-at-arms were training with blunted weapons. Nearby, Bronn sat on the lip of a well. A pair of comely serving girls sauntered past, carrying a wicker basket of rushes between them. But the cell sword never looked.
Bronn, I despair of you.
Tyrion gestured at the wenches. With sweet sights like that before you, all you see is a gaggle of louts raising a clangor.
There are 100 whorehouses in this city where a clip cooper will buy me all the cunt I want, Brun answered. But one day my life may hang, and how close I've watched your louts.
He stood.
Who's the boy in the checkered blue surcoat with the three eyes on his shield?
Some edge knight. Tallard, he names himself. Why?
Bronn pushed a fall of hair from his eyes.
He's the best of them, but watch him. He falls into a rhythm, delivering the same strokes in the same order each time he attacks. He grinned. That will be the death of him the day he faces me.
He's pledged to Joffrey. He's not like to face you.
They set off across the bailey, Bronn matching his long stride to Tyrion's short one. These days a sellsword was looking almost respectable. His dark hair was washed and brushed, he was freshly shaved, and he wore the black breastplate of an officer of the city watch. From his shoulders trailed a cloak of Lannister crimson patterned with gold hands. Tyrion had made him a gift of it when he named him captain of his personal guard.
"How many supplicants do we have today?" he inquired.
30-odd, answered Bronn. "Most with complaints, or wanting something as ever. Your pet was back."
He groaned.
"Lady Tanda, her page, she invites you to sup with her again. There's to be a haunch of venison, she says, a brace of stuffed geese, sauce with mulberries, and her daughter."
Tyrion finished sourly. Since the hour he had arrived in the Red Keep, Lady Tender had been stalking him, armed with a never-ending arsenal of lamprey pies, wild boars, and savoury cream stews. Somehow she had gotten the notion that a dwarf lordling would be the perfect consort for her daughter Lollies, a large, soft, dim-witted girl who rumour said was still a maid at 33.
"Send her my regrets."
"No taste for stuffed goose,"
Bronn grinned evilly.
"Perhaps you should eat the goose and marry the maid, or better still, send Shagger."
"Shagger's more like to eat the maid and marry the goose," observed Bronn. "Anyway, Lollies outweighs him."
"There is that," Tyrion admitted, as they passed under the shadow of a covered walkway between two towers.
"Who else wants me?"
The sellsword grew more serious.
"There's a moneylender from Braavos, holding fancy papers and the like. Request to see the king about payment on some loan."
"As if Joff could count past 20. Send the man to Littlefinger. He'll find a way to put him off. Next. A lordlin, down from the Trident, says your father's man burned his keep, raped his wife, and killed all his peasants.
I believe they call that war.
Tyrion smelled Gregor Clegane's work, or that of Sir Aimery Lorch, or his father's other pet hellhound, the Cohorric.
What does he want of Joffrey?
New peasants, Bronn said. He walked all this way to sing how loyal he is and beg for recompense.
I'll make time for him on the morrow.
Whether truly loyal or merely desperate, a compliant river lord might have his uses.
See that he is given a comfortable chamber and a hot meal. Send him a new pair of boots as well, good ones, courtesy of King Joffrey.
A show of generosity never hurt. Bronn gave a curt nod.
There's also a great gaggle of bakers, butchers, and greengrocers clamouring to be heard.
I told them last time I have nothing to give them.
Only a thin trickle of food was coming into King's Landing, most of it earmarked for castle and garrison. Prices had risen sickeningly high on greens, roots, flour, and fruit, and Tyrion did not want to think about what sorts of flesh might be going into the kettles of the pot shops down in Flea Bottom. Fish, he hoped. They still had the river and the sea, at least until Lord Stannis sailed.
They want protection. Last night a baker was roasted in his own oven. The mob claimed he charged too much for bread.
Did he?
He's not apt to deny it.
They didn't eat him, did they?
Not that I've heard.
Next time they will, Tyrion said grimly. I give them what protection I can. The gold cloaks.
They claim there are gold cloaks in the mob, Bronn said. They're demanding to speak to the king himself.
Tchie, fools.
Tyrion had sent them off with regrets. His nephew would send them off with whips and spears. He was half tempted to allow it. But no, he dare not. Soon or late, some enemy would march on King's Landing, and the last thing he wanted was willing traitors within the city walls.
Tell them King Joffrey shares their fears and would do all he can for them. They want bread, not promises. If I give them bread today, on the morrow I'll have twice as many at the gates. Who else?
A black brother, down from the wall. The steward says he brought some rotted and in a jar.
Tyrion smiled wanly.
I'm surprised no one ate it. I suppose I ought to see him. It's not Yoren, perchance.
No, some knight, Thorn.
Sir Alistair Thorn?
Of all the black brothers he'd met on the wall, Tyrion Lannister had liked Sir Alistair Thorn the least. A bitter, mean-spirited man, with too great a sense of his own worth.
Come to think of it, I don't believe I care to see Sir Alistair just now. Find him a snug sill where no one has changed the rushes in a year, and let his hand rot a little more.
Bronn snorted laughter and went his way, while Tyrion struggled up the serpentine steps. As he limped across the outer yard, he heard the portcullis rattling up. His sister and a large party were waiting by the main gate. Mounted on her white palfrey, Cersei towered high above him, a goddess in green.
"Brother," she called out, not warmly. The queen had not been pleased by the way he'd dealt with Janus Slint.
"Your grace," Tyrion bowed politely, "you look lovely this morning."
Her crown was gold, her cloak ermine. Her retinue sat their mounts behind her. Sir Boris Blunt, of the King's Guard, wearing white scale and his favourite scowl. Sir Balon Swan, bowslung from his silver inlay saddle. Lord Giles Rusby, his wheezing cough worse than ever. Halin, the pyromancer of the Alchemist Guild. And the Queen's newest favourite, their cousin Sir Lancel Lannister, her late husband's squire, up jumped tonight at the widow's insistence.
Valar and 20 guardsmen rode escort. "Where are you bound this day, sister?" Tyrion asked.
"I'm making a round of the gates to inspect all the new scorpions and spitfires. I would not have it thought that all of us are as indifferent to the city's defences as you seem to be."
Cersei fixed him with those clear green eyes of hers, beautiful even in their contempt. "I am informed that Renly Baratheon has marched from Highgarden. He's making his way up the Rose Road, with all his strength behind him."
"Varys gave me the same report. He could be here by the full moon." "Not at his present leisurely pace," Tyrion assured her. "He feasts every night in a different castle, and holds court at every crossroad he passes.
And every day more men rally to his banners. His host is now said to be 100,000 strong."
"That seems rather high. He has the power of Storm's End and Highgarden behind him, you little fool,"
Cersei snapped down at him. "All the Tyrell bannermen, but for the red wines, and you have me to thank for that. So long as I hold those poxy twins of his, Lord Paxter will squat on the arbour and count himself fortunate to be out of it."
"A pity you let the Knight of Flowers slip through your pretty fingers. Still, Renly has other concerns besides us. Our father at Heddon Hall, Robb Stark at River Run. Were I he, I would do much as he is doing.
Make my progress, flaunt my power for the realm to see. Watch, wait. Let my rivals contend while I bide my own sweet time. If Stark defeats us, the South will fall into Renly's hands like a windfall from the gods, and he'll not have lost a man. And if it goes the other way, he can descend on us while we are weakened."
Cersei was not appeased.
"I want you to make father bring his army to King's Landing."
"Well, it will serve no purpose but to make you feel safe."
"When have I ever been able to make father do anything?"
She ignored the question.
"And when do you plan to free Jaime? He's worth 100 of you."
Tyrion grinned crookedly. "Don't tell Lady Stark, I beg you. We don't have 100 of me to trade."
"Father must have been mad to send you. You're worse than useless." The queen jerked on her reins and wheeled her palfrey around. She rode out of the gate at a brisk trot, ermine cloak streaming behind her. Her retinue hastened after. In truth, Renly Baratheon did not frighten Tyrion half as much as his brother Stannis did. Renly was beloved of the commons, but he had never before led men in war. Stannis was otherwise, hard, cold, inexorable. If only he had some way of knowing what was happening at Dragonstone. But not one of the fisherfolk he had paid to spy out the island had ever returned, and even the informers the eunuch claimed to have placed in Stannis's household had been ominously silent. The striped hulls of Lycian war galleys had been seen offshore, though, and Varys had reports from Myr of sail-sail captains taking service with Dragonstone.
If Stannis attacks by sea while his brother Renly storms the gates, they'll soon be mounting Joffrey's head on a spike. Worse, mine will be beside him.
A depressing thought. You ought to make plans to get Shae safely out of the city should the worst seem likely.
Podrick Payne stood at the door of his solar, studying the floor.
"He's inside," he announced to Tyrion's belt buckle. "Your solar, my lord. Sorry."
Tyrion sighed.
"Look at me, Pud. It unnerves me when you talk to my codpiece, especially when I'm not wearing one. Who is inside my solar?"
"Lord Littlefinger."
Podrick managed a quick look at his face, then hastily dropped his eyes.
"I meant Lord Petire, Lord Baelish, the Master of Coin."
"You make him sound a crowd."
The boy hunched down as if struck, making Tyrion feel absurdly guilty.
Lord Petire was seated on his window seat, languid and elegant, in a plush plum-coloured doublet and a yellow satin cape, one gloved hand resting on his knee.
"The king is fighting hares with a crossbow," he said. "The hares are winning. Come, see."
Tyrion had to stand on his toes to get a look. A dead hare lay on the ground below. Another, long ears twitching, was about to expire from the bolt in his side. Spent quarrels lay strewn across the hard-packed earth, like straw scattered by a storm. "Now!" Joff shouted. The gamesman released the hare he was holding, and he went bounding off. Joffrey jerked the trigger on the crossbow, the bolt missed by 2 feet. The hare stood on his hind legs and twitched his nose at the king. Cursing, Joff spun the wheel to winch back his string, but the animal was gone before he was loaded. "Another!" The gamesman reached into the hutch. This one made a brown streak against the stone, while Joffrey's hurried shot almost took Sir Preston in the groin. Littlefinger turned away.
"Boy, are you fond of potted hair?"
he asked Podrick Payne. Pod stared at the visitor's boots, lovely things of red-dyed leather ornamented with black scrollwork.
"To eat, my lord." "Invest in pots," Littlefinger advised. "Hares will soon overrun the castle. We'll be eating hare thrice a day."
"Better than rats on a skewer," said Tyrion. "Pod leave us, unless Lord Petire would care for some refreshment."
"Thank you, but no."
Littlefinger flashed his mocking smile.
"Drink with a dwarf its head, and you wake up walking the wall. Black brings out my unhealthy pallor."
"Have no fear, my lord," thought Tyrion. "It's not the wall I have in mind for you."
He seated himself in a high chair piled with cushions and said, "You look very elegant today, my lord."
"I am wounded. I strive to look elegant every day."
"Is the doublet new?"
"It is, or most observant."
"Plum and yellow. Are those the colours of your house?"
"No, but a man gets bored wearing the same colours day in and day out, or so I've found."
"That's a handsome knife as well."
"Is it?"
There was mischief in Littlefinger's eyes. He drew the knife and glanced at it casually, as if he had never seen it before.
"Valyrian steel, and a dragonbone hilt. A trifle plain, though. It's yours, if you would like it."
"Mine?" Tyrion gave him a long look.
"No, I think not. Never mine."
"He knows, the insolent wretch. He knows, and he knows that I know, and he thinks that I cannot touch him."
If ever truly a man had armoured himself in gold, it was Petire Baelish, not Jaime Lannister. Jaime's famous armour was but gilded steel, but Littlefinger's... Ah! Tyrion had learned a few things about sweet Petire to his growing disquiet. 10 years ago, John Aaron had given him a minor sinecure in customs, where Lord Petire had soon distinguished himself by bringing in 3 times as much as any of the king's other collectors. King Robert had been a prodigious spender. A man like Petire Baelish, who had a gift for rubbing 2 gold dragons together to breed a third, was invaluable to his hand. Littlefinger's rise had been arrow-swift. Within 3 years of his coming to court, he was master of coin and a member of the small council. And today, the crown's revenues were 10 times what they had been under his beleaguered predecessor, though the crown's debts had grown vast as well. A master juggler was Petire Baelish. Oh, he was clever. He did not simply collect the gold and lock it in a treasure vault, no. He paid the king's debts in promises and put the king's gold to work. He bought wagons, shops, ships, houses. He bought grain when it was plentiful and sold bread when it was scarce. He bought wool from the north and linen from the south and lace from Lice, stored it, moved it, dyed it, sold it. The golden dragons bred and multiplied, and Littlefinger lent them out and brought them home with hatchlings. And in the process he moved his own men into place. The keepers of the keys were his, all four. The king's counter and the king's scales were men he'd named. The officers in charge of all three mints, harbour masters, tax farmers, customs sergeants, wool factors, toll collectors, pursers, wine factors, 9 of every 10 belonged to Littlefinger. They were men of middling birth, by and large, merchants' sons, lesser lordlings, sometimes even foreigners, but judging from their results, far more able than their high-born predecessors. No one had ever thought to question the appointments, and why should they? Littlefinger was no threat to anyone. A clever, smiling, genial man, everyone's friend, always able to find whatever gold the king or his hand required, and yet of such undistinguished birth, one step up from a hedge knight, that he was not a man to fear. He had no banners to call, no army of retainers, no great stronghold, no holdings to speak of, no prospects of a great marriage. "But do I dare touch him?" Tyrion wondered. "Even if he is a traitor." He was not at all certain he could, least of all now, while the war raged. Given time, he could replace Littlefinger's men with his own in key positions, but a shout rang up from the yard. "Ah, his grace has killed a hare," Lord Baelish observed. "No doubt a slow one," Tyrion said. "My lord, you are fostered at River Run. I've heard it said that you grew close to the Tullys."
"You might say so. The girls especially."
"How close?"
"I had their maidenheads. Is that close enough?"
The lie, Tyrion was fairly certain it was a lie, was delivered with such an air of nonchalance that one could almost believe it. Could it have been Catelyn Stark who lied about her defloration and the dagger as well? The longer he lived, the more Tyrion realized that nothing was simple and little was true. "Lord Astor's daughters do not love me," he confessed. "I doubt they would listen to any proposal I might make. Yet coming from you, the same words might fall more sweetly on their ears."
"That would depend on the words. If you mean to offer Sansa in return for your brother, waste someone else's time. Joffrey will never surrender his plaything, and Lady Catelyn is not so great a fool as to barter the Kingslayer for a slip of a girl. I mean to have Arya as well. I have men searching. Searching is not finding.
I'll keep that in mind, my lord. In any case, it was Lady Lysa I hoped you might sway. For her, I have a sweeter offer."
"Lysa is more tractable than Catelyn, true, but also more fearful, and I understand she hates you."
"She believes she has a good reason. When I was her guest at the Eyrie, she insisted that I'd murdered her husband, and was not inclined to listen to denials." He leaned forward. "If I gave her John Aaron's true killer, she might think more kindly of me." That made Littlefinger sit up.
"True killer? I confess. You make me curious. Who do you propose?"
It was Tyrion's turn to smile. "Gifts I give my friends freely. Lysa Aaron would need to understand that."
"Is it her friendship you require, or her swords?"
"Both." Littlefinger stroked the neat spike of his beard.
"Lysa has woes of her own. Clansmen, raiding out of the Mountains of the Moon in greater numbers than ever before, and better armed."
"Distressing," said Tyrion Lannister, who had armed them. "I could help her with that. A word from me."
And what would that word cost her?
I want Lady Lysa and her son to acclaim Joffrey as king, to swear fealty, and to
make war on the Starks and Tullys.
Littlefinger shook his head.
There's the roach in your pudding, Lannister. Lysa will never send her knights against River Run.
Nor would I ask it. We have no lack of enemies.
I'll use her power to oppose Lord Renly or Lord Stannis, should he stir from Dragonstone. In return, I will give her justice for John Arryn and peace in the Vale. I will even name that appalling child of hers Warden of the East, as his father was before him.
I want to see him fly,
a boy's voice whispered faintly in memory. And to seal the bargain, I will give her my niece.
He had the pleasure of seeing a look of genuine surprise in Petyr Baelish's grey-green eyes.
Marcella?
When she comes of age, she can wed little Lord Robert. Until such time, she'll be Lady Lysa's ward at the Eyrie.
And what does Her Grace the Queen think of this ploy?
When Tyrion shrugged, Littlefinger burst into laughter.
I thought not. You're a dangerous little man, Lannister. Yes, I could sing this song to Lysa.
Again the sly smile, the mischief in his glance.
If I cared to.
Tyrion nodded, waiting, knowing Littlefinger could never abide a long silence.
So, Lord Petyr continued after a pause, utterly unabashed, what's in your pot for me?
Arranal?
It was interesting to watch his face. Lord Petyr's father had been the smallest of small lords, his grandfather a landless hedge knight. By birth he held no more than a few stony acres on the windswept shore of the Fingers. Harrenhal was one of the richest plums in the Seven Kingdoms, its lands broad and rich and fertile, its great castle as formidable as any in the realm, and so large as to dwarf River Run, where Petyr Baelish had been fostered by House Tully, only to be brusquely expelled when he dared raise his sights to Lord Hoster's daughter. Littlefinger took a moment to adjust the drape of his cape, but Tyrion had seen the flash of hunger in those sly cat's eyes.
I have him, he knew.
Harrenhal is cursed, Lord Petyr said after a moment, trying to sound bored.
Then raise it to the ground and build anew to suit yourself. You'll have no lack of coin. I mean to make you liege lord of the Trident. These river lords have proven they cannot be trusted. Let them do you fealty for their lands.
Even the Tullys, if there are any Tullys left when we are done.
Littlefinger looked like a boy who had just taken a furtive bite from a honeycomb. He was trying to watch for bees, but the honey was so sweet.
Harrenhal and all its lands and incomes, he mused.
With a stroke, you'd make me one of the greatest lords in the realm. Not that I'm ungrateful, my lord, but, why?
You serve my sister well in the matter of their succession.
As did Jaina Slint, on whom this same castle of Harrenhal was quite recently bestowed. Only to be snatched away when he was no longer of use.
Tyrion laughed.
You have me, my lord, what can I say? I need you to deliver the Lady Lysa. I did not need Jaina Slint.
He gave a crooked shrug.
I'd sooner have you seated in Arranal than Renly seated on the Iron Throne. What could be plainer?
What indeed? You realize that I may need to bed Lysa Arryn again to get her consent to this marriage.
I have little doubt you'll be equal to the task.
I once told Ned Stark that when you find yourself naked with an ugly woman,
The only thing to do is close your eyes and get on with it." Littlefinger steepled his fingers and gazed into Tyrion's mismatched eyes. "Give me a fortnight to conclude my affairs and arrange for a ship to carry me to Gulltown. That will do nicely." His guest rose. "This has been quite the pleasant morning, Lannister, and profitable for both of us, I trust." He bowed, his cape a swirl of yellow, as he strode out the door. Two for Tyrion. He went up to his bedchamber to wait Varys, who would soon be making an appearance. Evenfall, he guessed. Perhaps as late as moonrise, though he hoped not. He hoped to visit Shae tonight. He was pleasantly surprised when Galt of the Stonecrows informed him, not an hour later, that the powdered man was at his door. "You are a cruel man to make the Grand Maester squirm so," the eunuch scolded. "The man cannot abide a secret."
"Is that a crow I hear, calling the raven black? Or would you sooner not hear what I proposed to Doran Martell?"
Varys giggled. "Perhaps my little birds have told me."
"Have they indeed?" He wanted to hear this. "Go on."
"The Dornish men have thus far held aloof from these walls. Doran Martell has called his banners, but no more. His hatred for House Lannister is well known, and it is commonly thought he will join Lord Renly. You wish to dissuade him?"
"All this is obvious," said Tyrion.
"The only puzzle is what you might have offered for his allegiance. The prince is a sentimental man, and he still mourns his sister Ilya and her sweet babe."
"My father once told me that a lord never lets sentiment get in the way of ambition, and it happens we have an empty seat on the small council, now that Lord Janus has taken the black."
"A council seat is not to be despised," Varys admitted. "Yet will it be enough to make a proud man forget his sister's murder?"
"Why forget?" Tyrion smiled. "I promised to deliver his sister's killers, alive or dead, as he prefers. After the war is done, to be sure." Varys gave him a shrewd look.
"My little birds tell me that Princess Ilya cried a certain name when they came for her."
"Is a secret still a secret if everyone knows it?" "In Casterly Rock, it was common knowledge that Gregor Clegane had killed Ilya and her babe. They said he had raped the princess with her son's blood and brains still on his hands."
"This secret is your lord father's sworn man."
"My father would be the first to tell you that 50,000 Dornish men are worth one rabid dog." Varys stroked a powdered cheek.
"And if Prince Doran demands the blood of the lord who gave the command, as well as the knight who did the deed?"
"Robert Baratheon led the rebellion. All commands came from him in the end."
"Robert was not at King's Landing."
"Neither was Doran Martell.
So, blood for his pride, a chair for his ambition. Gold and land, that goes without saying. A sweet offer, yet sweets can be poisoned. If I were the prince, something more would I require before I should reach for this honeycomb. Some token of good faith, some sure safeguard against betrayal."
Varys smiled his slimy smile.
"Which one will you give him, I wonder?"
Tyrion sighed. "You know, don't you?"
"Since you put it that way, yes. Tommen
You could scarcely offer Missella to Doran Martell and Lysa Aaron both. Remind me never to play these guessing games with you again. You cheat. Prince Tommen is a good boy. If I pry him away from Cersei and Joffrey while he's still young, he might even grow to be a good man. And a good king. Joffrey is king, and Tommen is heir, should anything ill befall his grace. Tommen, whose nature is so sweet and notably tractable. You have a suspicious mind, Varys. I shall take that as a tribute, my lord. In any case, Prince Doran would hardly be insensible of the great honour you do him. Very deftly done, I would say. But for one small flaw. The dwarf laughed. Named Cersei? What avails statecraft against the love of a mother for the sweet fruit of her womb? Perhaps for the glory of her house and the safety of the realm, the queen might be persuaded to send away Tommen or Missella, but both of them surely not. What Cersei does not know will never hurt me. And if Her Grace were to discover your intentions before your plans are ripe... Why, he said, then I would know the man who told her to be my certain enemy. And when Varys giggled, he thought, three. Catelyn.
We will make King's Landing within the hour.
Catelyn turned away from the rail and forced herself to smile. Your Ormen have done well by us, Captain. Each one of them shall have a silver stag as a token of my gratitude. Captain Mario Tumitus favoured her with a half bow.
You're far too generous, Lady Stark. The honour of carrying a great lady like yourself is all the reward they need.
But they'll take the silver anyway. Mario smiled.
As you say.
He spoke the common tongue fluently, with only the slightest hint of a Tyrushi accent. He'd been plying the narrow sea for 30 years, he told her, as oarman, quartermaster, and finally captain of his own trading galleys. The Storm Dancer was his fourth ship, and his fastest, a 2-masted galley of 60 oars. She had certainly been the fastest of the ships available in White Harbour when Catelyn and Sir Roderick Cassel had arrived after their headlong gallop downriver. The Tyrushi were notorious for their avarice, and Sir Roderick had argued for hiring a fishing sloop out of the Three Sisters, but Catelyn had insisted on the galley. It was good that she had. The winds had been against them much of the voyage, and without the galley's oars... they'd still be beating their way past the Fingers, instead of skimming towards King's Landing and Journey's End. So close, she thought. Beneath the linen bandages, her fingers still throbbed where the dagger had bitten. The pain was her scourge, Catelyn felt, lest she forget. She could not bend the last 2 fingers of her left hand, and the others would never again be dexterous. Yet that was a small enough price to pay for Bran's life. Sir Roderick chose that moment to appear on deck.
"My good friend," said Mario through his forked green beard.
The Tyrushi loved bright colours, even in their facial hair.
"It's so fine to see you looking better."
"Yes," Sir Roderick agreed. "I haven't wanted to die for almost 2 days now." He bowed to Catelyn. "My lady." He was looking better. A shade thinner than he had been when they set out from White Harbour, but almost himself again. The strong winds in the bight and the roughness of the narrow sea had not agreed with him, and he'd almost gone over the side when the storm seized them unexpectedly off Dragonstone. Yet somehow he had clung to a rope until 3 of Mario's men could rescue him and carry him safely below decks. The captain was just telling me that our voyage is almost at an end, she said. Sir Roderick managed a wry smile.
So soon?
He looked odd without his great white side whiskers. Smaller somehow, less fierce, and 10 years older. Yet back on the Bight, it had seemed prudent to submit to a crewman's razor, after his whiskers had become hopelessly befouled for the third time, while he leaned over the rail and retched into the swirling winds.
"I will leave you to discuss your business," Captain Morio said.
He bowed and took his leave of them. The galley skimmed the water like a dragonfly, her oars rising and falling in perfect time. Sir Roderick held the rail and looked out over the passing shore.
"I have not been the most valiant of protectors."
Catelyn touched his arm. "We are here, Sir Roderick, and safely. That is all that truly matters." Her hand groped beneath her cloak, her fingers stiff and fumbling. The dagger was still at her side. She found she had to touch it now and then to reassure herself. "Now we must reach the King's Master-at-Arms and pray he can be trusted. Sir Aaron Santagar is a vain man, but an honest one." Sir Roderick's hand went to his face and stroked his whiskers and discovered once again they were gone. He looked nonplussed.
"He may know the blade, yes, but, my lady, the moment we go ashore we are at risk, and there are those at court who will know you on sight."
Catelyn's mouth grew tight. "Littlefinger," she murmured. His face swam up before her, a boy's face, though he was a boy no longer. His father had died several years before, so he was Lord Baelish now. Yet still they called him Littlefinger. Her brother Edmure had given him that name long ago at Riveron. His family's modest holdings were on the smallest of the fingers, and Petire had been slight and short for his age. Sir Roderick cleared his throat.
"Lord Baelish, once,
His thought trailed off uncertainly in a search of the polite word. Catelyn was past delicacy. "He was my father's ward. We grew up together in Riveron. I thought of him as a brother, but his feelings for me were more than brotherly. When it was announced that I was to wed Brandon Stark, Petire challenged for the right to my hand. It was madness. Brandon was 20. Petire scarcely 15. I had to beg Brandon to spare Petire's life. He let him off with a scar. Afterward, my father sent him away. I have not seen him since." She lifted her face to the spray, as if the brisk wind could blow the memories away. "He wrote to me at Riveron after Brandon was killed, but I burned the letter unread. By then I knew that Ned would marry me in his brother's place." Sir Roderick's fingers fumbled once again for non-existent whiskers.
"Littlefinger sits on the small council now."
"Well, I knew he would rise high," Catelyn said. "He was always clever, even as a boy. But it's one thing to be clever and another to be wise. I wonder what the years have done to him." High overhead, the far eye sang out from the rigging. Captain Murillo came scrambling across the deck, giving orders, and all around them the Storm Dancer burst into frenetic activity as King's Landing slid into view atop three high hills. 300 years ago, Catelyn knew, those heights had been covered with forest, and only a handful of fisher folk had lived on the north shore of the Blackwater Rush, where that deep, swift river flowed into the sea. Then Aegon the Conqueror had sailed from Dragonstone. It was here that his army had put ashore, and there, on the highest hill, that he built his first crude redoubt of wood and earth. Now the city covered the shore as far as Catelyn could see. Manses and arbours and granaries, brick storehouses and timbered inns and merchant stalls, taverns and graveyards and brothels all piled one on another. She could hear the clamour of the fish market even at this distance. Between the buildings were broad roads lined with trees, wandering crookback streets, an alley so narrow that two men could not walk abreast. Visenya's hill was crowned by the great sept of Baelor with its seven crystal towers. Across the city on the hill of Rhaenys stood the blackened wall of the Dragon Pit, its huge dome collapsing into ruin, its bronze doors closed now for a century. The Street of the Sisters ran between them, straight as an arrow. The city walls rose in the distance, high and strong. 100 quays lined the waterfront, and the harbour was crowded with ships. Deep-water fishing boats and river runners came and went. Ferrymen poled back and forth across the Blackwater Rush. Trading galleys unloaded goods from Braavos and Pentos and Lys. Catelyn spied the Queen's ornate barge tied up beside a fat-bellied whaler from the port of Ibben, its hull black with tar, while upriver a dozen lean golden warships rested in their cribs, sails furled, and cruel iron rams lapping at the water. And above it all, frowning down from Aegon's high hill, was a red keep. 7 huge drum towers crowned with iron ramparts, an immense grim barbican, vaulted halls and covered bridges, barracks and dungeons and granaries, massive curtain walls studded with archers' nests, all fashioned of pale red stone. Aegon the Conqueror had commanded it built. His son, Maegor the Cruel, had seen it completed. Afterwards he had taken the heads of every stonemason, woodworker and builder who had laboured on it. Only the blood of the dragon would ever know the secrets of the fortress the dragon lords had built, he vowed. Yet now the banners that flew from its battlements were golden, not black, and where the three-headed dragon had once breathed fire, now pranced the crown stag of House Baratheon. A high-masted swan ship from the Summer Isles was beating out from port, its white sails huge with wind. The Storm Dancer moved past it, pulling steadily for shore.
"My lady," Sir Roderick said, "I have thought on how best to proceed while I lay abed. You must not enter the castle. I will go in your stead, and bring Sir Aaron to you in some safe place."
She studied the old knight as the galley drew near to a pier. Murillo was shouting in the vulgar Valyrian of the free cities,
"You'd be as much at risk as I would."
Sir Roderick smiled.
"I think not. I looked at my reflection in the water earlier and scarcely recognized myself. My mother was the last person to see me without whiskers, and she is 40 years dead. I believe I am safe enough, my lady."
Murillo bellowed a command. As one, 60 oars lifted from the river, then reversed and backed water. The galley slowed. Another shout. The oar slipped back inside the hull. As they thumped against the dock, Tyroshi seamen leapt down to tie up. Murillo came bustling up, all smiles.
"King's Landing, my lady, as you did command, and never has a ship made a swifter or shorter passage. Will you be needing assistance to carry your things to the castle?"
"We shall not be going to the castle. Perhaps you can suggest an inn, some place clean and comfortable, and not too far from the river." The Tyroshi fingered his forked green beard.
"Just so. I know of several establishments that might suit your needs. Yet first, if I may be so bold, there is the matter of the second half of the payment we agreed upon, and of course the extra silver you were so kind as to promise. 60 stags, I believe it was."
"For the oarman," Catelyn reminded him.
"Oh, of a certainty," said Mario, "though perhaps I should hold it for them until we return to Tyrosh, for the sake of their wives and children. If you give them the silver ear, my lady, they will dice it away, or spend it all for a night's pleasure."
"There are worse things to spend money on," Sir Roderick put in.
"Winter is coming."
"A man must make his own choices," Catelyn said. "They earn the silver. How they spend it is no concern of mine.
"As you say, my lady,"
Maria replied, bowing and smiling. Just to be sure, Catelyn paid the oarman herself, a stag to each man, and a copper to the two men who carried their chests.